My guest today, Marta Zaraska, is a Polish-Canadian science journalist who's written everywhere from the Washington Post, Scientific American, to New Scientist, The Atlantic Discover, and so many others. Her articles and books have been turned into TV shows in the U.S., Spain, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Russia, Bulgaria, Germany, and Poland, and reprinted around the globe from Oman to Dubai, Australia, and Singapore. She personally has visited over 80 countries in the world, lived in six of them, reported from Rwanda, DR Congo, Nicaragua, India, Togo, Cameroon, and many other places, and currently lives in a tiny village with her husband and daughter in France. Marta's new book, Growing Young, How Friendship, Optimism, and Kindness Can Help You Live to 100, is a research-driven case for why optimism, kindness, and strong social networks will keep us living longer than any fitness tracker or other sort of common popular fad or phenomenon. This is a conversation we need more now than ever. So excited to share it with you. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Good Life Project is sponsored by the ADHD Aha podcast hosted by Laura Key. So I've been kind of amazed at how many conversations I've had lately with people later in life who are wondering if they have ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. So in each episode of ADHD Aha, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, even funny ways that ADHD symptoms surface for adults. Like the recent episode with ADHD coach Emily Weinberg, which really resonated with me. Her story about how she was thinking she was, quote, just lazy before her diagnosis because she wasn't hyperactive really struck a chord. Her feeling frozen and stuck, ruminating on mounting to-do lists is just so relatable for so many people. It's really validating to hear others articulate those experiences. Each episode of ADHD Aha features candid tales of realizing that you or a loved one has ADHD. You'll hear the unexpected, emotional ways that it manifests in adults through heartfelt interviews. ADHD Aha captures the authentic human experience of ADHD. So if you want a fresh, personal perspective that embraces the messiness, listen to ADHD Aha. Search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. It's an aha moment you won't miss. Good Life Project is brought to you by Air Doctor, makers of those amazing air purifiers I keep in my home studio and have been talking about for a long time now. So even though I talk for a living, my vocal pipes could use some help dealing with indoor air, which can contain so many different irritants. Luckily, my trusty Air Doctor uses an incredibly advanced Ultra HEPA filter to capture particles 100 times smaller than old school HEPA filters. We're talking smoke, pollen, mold, bacteria, all those nasty micro critters in the air. My Air Doctor just gobbles them up so I can podcast and breathe and write and be in peace and with peace of mind. So give your indoor air a purification boost with Air Doctor. Air Doctor comes with a 30-day breathe easy money back guarantee. So if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund minus shipping. Head to airdoctorpro.com and use the promo code GOODLIFE and you'll receive up to $300 off air purifiers. Exclusive to podcast customers, you'll also receive a free 3-year warranty on any unit, which is an additional $84 value. So lock this special offer in by going to airdoctorpro.com or airdoctorpro.com, or just click the link in the show notes and use the promo code GOODLIFE. I'm in New York City. You're in a small town in France. Grew up originally in Poland. I guess outside of Warsaw or somewhere else?
No, also middle of nowhere. So,
got it. And you also, so you would have been kind of a growing up and a teen through the whole solidarity movement, like Walesa coming in.
Yep.
Was that a sort of a conscious part of your upbringing and your experience as a kid there?
It was extremely important. I mean, my dad was very involved in the whole movement against Communist Party. So we had communist government agents placed outside of our house on a permanent basis. So it was quite an important part of
life. Did you have a sense of, having those agents placed outside your house, was there a sense of fear around that at all? Or just sort of like you had to act in a certain way and behave in a certain way?
I mean, not for me as a child, because my parents kept me quiet, unaware of what's going on. Only as an adult, I learned that, a few times my father was fearing he'll not be coming back home and said he'll be going to prison. So as a political prisoner, and my parents were starting to pack suitcases in the middle of the night. I just never knew about those things. So for me, it was a pretty awesome childhood, but just not really aware of all these things going on. So.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine the conversations afterwards, sort of like in hindsight, sitting down with your parents would be pretty eye-opening.
Yeah.
You end up, I guess, going out into the world and starting a career as a journalist, reporting, traveling a lot. But also you end up in law school, and so you have degrees in law and photography.
I mean, it's mostly that. The photography was just kind of a diploma, but I'm a lawyer by education, which surprises a lot of people because they think, what does a lawyer have to do with science journalism? But the thing is, I really think that my degree in journalism prepared me to be a science journalist, because when you think about law, it's all about fact-finding and making sure that the argument has no holes in it, and also looking from different perspective and trying to see the different side of things and really looking for proof and making sure it's solid. So this is something that really, this kind of training really helped me in my science journalism, although I've been a journalist as well for over 20 years. So I've never worked as a journalist professionally.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I have... So I have a background in law also. I practiced for about four or five years. Similar to you, it was a very long time in my past at this point. But I agree, it gives you a way to look at things, to understand, to question them, to analyze them, to understand arguments on both sides. And I feel like, especially as a journalist, it would be valuable, because part of the training of law is you're taught to look at both sides. If you're representing this or this, what would be the arguments? And I feel like in journalism, really good journalism does that.
Yeah, it should, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm curious about the photography side also. I know you sort of downplayed that a little bit, but I'm curious what drew you to that, and whether, as you're out in the field, now a couple of decades into journalism, whether the photographer's lens eye in some way affects that.
I mean, I did use my photography skill in my work as a journalist as well. Because at the very beginning, I used to be a foreign affairs journalist. So I was reporting from Africa and other developing countries, but mostly in Africa. So I was doing also photography to accompany my stories. It was always kind of more of a social, environmental, human rights side, the kind of reporting I was doing. So I did do photography as well for work as a journalist before. Right now, when I'm doing purely science, then there is much less opportunity to use my photography, although it does happen from time to time as well.
Yeah. What happens that tips you into science journalism? Because it seems like that is, from covering a wide range of things, traveling a ton, this, especially over the last 4 or 5 years, has become a really strong focus.
I mean, I've been doing it for well over 10 years now, 12 or something like that. And I stopped doing so much foreign affairs and Africa stuff, stories, because I was also settling down, private life and starting a family, and that was not the best lifestyle, both time-wise and safety-wise, since I was going to places like Democratic Republic of the Congo, for example, during the conflict. And so definitely being a science journalist, that goes much better with family. And and I'm married to a scientist as well. That's definitely, you know, so we both spend our days reading academic journals and talking to other scientists. So that's kind of a natural path for me.
Yeah. It seems like, you know, you've written for so many different places. You wrote a piece for Siam Mind, I think it was in 2015, that I thought was sort of like one of the interesting things early that I saw, at least my exposure to your writing. It was about happiness and age, which also to me in a weird way, I wondered if it was the earliest seeds of your most recent book. But it was eye-opening because I think a lot of people think, well, as you get older, you decline and all sorts of things, and it must be the least happy part of your life. And in fact, you know, as you shared, it's not.
Yeah, it was a quite an interesting piece for me as well, because exactly, and very optimistic as well, right? That's people often assume that when we age, we just become this miserable, unhappy creatures, and everything just goes downhill at some point from, I don't know, starting at 50 or something like that. But the truth is that it's the opposite, that people actually tend to be the most miserable in their midlife, and then things start improving, and only in extreme old age, just the few last months maybe are not that happy. But generally, you know, in their 60s and 70s, even early 80s, people tend to be happier than people in their 30s and 40s. And this is for one reason for that is just lifestyle and just basically environmental reasons, so that you have less responsibility, you don't have kids living at home, you have less pressure at work or no work anymore. So it's generally just the environment in which you live, but also there are actual biological changes, right, to the brain, and the way we are wired makes us more likely to become happy later in life.
Yeah, I love that. And like you said, it's hopeful. Yeah. I guess right around that time also, you were working on, would have been your first book, Meat Hooked?
Yes. So I started working on Meat Hooked in 2014, I think, and it was published in 2016. So
right. So I have to ask the horrible pun, like what got your hooks into this particular thing as a topic?
I mean, it's all related, right? Because Meat Hooked was about nutrition is about health as well. So it's all very much connected. And Meat Hooked was on nutrition, but also on psychology, because it was history and science of our obsession. Why do we love meat so much? So it was very much based in psychology and nutrition, which are the topics I've been writing about for over a decade now. So it was also kind of a natural thing. And also because I myself am kind of a struggling vegetarian. So that's why I was interested in this particular topic as well.
Yeah, which evolves us to your current book, Growing Young. And I want to dive into a whole bunch of ideas around this because I'm fascinated by it. You know, I have lived in this world of, you know, talking to so many different people and doing a whole bunch of different reading, exploration around, however you frame it, as lifespan, life extension, you know, like growing old, all these different things, and what makes a difference, what doesn't make a difference, what are we actually talking about when we're talking about all of these things? And you kind of take everything and roll it into one big giant exploration and come up with some surprising ideas. First, I have to tell you, a book about living well and living long that has a two-layer, what seems to be buttercream pink cake on the cover of it, automatically I have to love, because there's a sense of freedom in that. But, you know, I think the first question I actually really want to ask you is, when we talk about aging, what are we actually talking about?
So, of course, it depends who you are asking. So some people, when they hear aging, they think about some kind of outside beauty. So your wrinkles, whether, you know, your hair is graying or falling out, or they're thinking about Botox and plastic surgery. And this is not absolutely not what I'm writing about. So I'm never saying that we should try to keep our, you know, appearance or anything like that, because this is not what it's about. It's about also embracing aging and just enjoying it, basically. But the truth is that that if we take care of our health, then they both go together. So, and looks often follow as well, but although this is not, you know, the most important part, but sometimes it also happens, so that, you know, we stay healthy, we age well, we live long. It's all connected. You know, sometimes people tell me that they actually don't want to live to 100 because they fear they will be very sick for a very long time, and this is not an appealing perspective. But the truth is that this usually doesn't happen that way. So people who are in good health tend to live long in good health. It's people who struggle health-wise. They stay sick for longer periods and they also die younger. And actually, the most bizarre statistic, one of the bizarre statistics I've read, is that people who live to be 110 or more, 10% of them, so 1 in 10, escapes disease until the very last 3 months of life. So they are healthy for 109 years and 9 months, let's say, and then only 3 last months they are kind of sickish and then they pass away, which is amazing, you know, when you think about it, that you can stay healthy for, let's say, 109 years. And it's the people who live the statistical 82, 81 years who are more likely actually to spend more time being infirm.
Yeah, I remember reading you shared something like 18% of people who live an average lifespan, or people who live an average lifespan spend something like 18% of that entire life ill. Whereas people who are the centenarians who live past 100, I think the average was only 5%. So like you were describing, it's health, 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 and then just very quickly towards just the absolute end, which is kind of counterintuitive. And I guess part of the question also is, you know, like what it speaks to the idea of health span versus lifespan also, you know, like instead of optimizing for years, optimizing for years spent in good health, which I think has become a real big focus for so many these days.
But it also seems that those two are connected, right? So it's not like lifespan versus health span. It seems that if you go for health span, you are very likely to end up with lifespan as well. So it's kind of unlikely for you to get very long lifespan and be sick a lot of the time. I mean, it does happen, but it's not a common thing.
Yeah, and when we think about longevity, I know the first metric that most people point to is your chronological age, like how are you? When were you born? This is your age. And so in theory, you know, that is about how old you would be. And I think for a long time, we just kind of assumed that if that's your age, well, the average person is going to have these particular things associated with that age. And but these days, I think we're not just measuring age chronologically now, but also, you know, people are pointing to these internal things, to all sorts of other things, to try and sort of use them as metrics for. But how old are you actually really on a physiological level? Can you talk a little bit about some of the things that we're looking at?
Yeah, so there are, of course, chronological age doesn't tell you a lot about person's age, and not only later in life, but even when you are talking about three-year-old children, actually there are already differences. And the reason for that is that we have those telomeres, you might have heard about them, and so these are the protective caps and at the ends of our chromosomes that take an important part in the way we age. The most simplistic view is that, you know, that when they get shorter, it also means that we kind of are older. But the truth is that they already start shortening when we are still in our mother's wombs. And actually, they shorten the fastest during the first 4 years of life. And then you can, if you compare the lengths of different people's telomeres, in general, this is one of the ways of looking how their age compares biologically. There is also something called then DNA methylation clock. That's another type of clock that scientists use based on epigenetics to measure how differently aged biologically people's bodies are. All those clocks are still very much imperfect. So when you very often, for example, on the internet, you can see some labs offering to measure your telomeres, to tell you how old you are or your methylation clock. But the truth is that it doesn't work that way yet. You know, we can use those tools for research, for comparing populations, for example, but definitely you cannot just simply get it measured and tell you, okay, your birth certificate says you're 30, but really you're 25 or 45. It just doesn't work that way. It's far too early in science for us to be able to measure it on an individual level.
Yeah, I mean, I have seen all of these sort of like commercial ways to measure your telomeres. I know it's been a hot topic of conversation in the biohacking community for a number of years now. And it was interesting to hear the research that you shared, which says that so much of the variation actually is set up either at birth or shortly after, you know. So, and it's interesting because I have had friends that have measured their telomeres or, you know, like send it to whatever the service was, and then eaten and changed their lifestyle and moved their body in a particular way, and a year later sent in, you know, like had themselves retested and had very different numbers and said, well, you know, like I had a much healthier lifestyle and now it shows that I have reversed age 10 years. But I guess what you're saying is that that's not really the way it works, or at least the science
not
isn't there
all.
Yet.
Absolutely not. Those services just don't use them. Basically, that's the lesson here. Because the truth is that the measurements are also so imprecise that if you measure your telomeres and send them to the swap or whatever they are requesting from you and send it to several different labs, they will give you a completely different result. Even if you give two swabs to the same lab, one after another, you know, from the same day, they will most likely come up with a very different result. So it's extremely imprecise and tells you basically nothing. So not on an individual level, it's just basically a waste of money.
Interesting. As part of your research, were you curious, did you actually do any of that yourself?
I didn't do that. I did a lot of other stuff on myself, yeah. But some of them quite unpleasant and involving blood draws, but not that particular, no.
Yeah. The other thing that you mentioned was DNA methylation. I know that's been a bigger part of the conversation, I think, in functional medicine, integrative medicine these days, which is really looking at sort of the epigenetic state of your genes, like what's turned on, what's turned off, how does environment, how do genetics affect this? It feels like that has been a more robust field of investigation.
I mean, once again, they measure very different things, telomeres and DNA methylation clocks. They measure very different things, and they are both research only right now. And DNA methylation is also not for the individual measurement of how old you are at all. Actually, one of the top scientists who researches DNA methylation clocks, he told me that one of his big fears is that it will become the same hype as surrounding telomeres, because it's basically completely incorrect. It's just a waste of people's money, and it's just skews the perception, whereas it's not what it's for. It's not for, you know, me or you just to learn whether we are really 40 or 50. It just doesn't work that way.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Wonderful Pistachios. So listen up, all you busy bosses running around town, fueling your days with sad desk snacks. This is a PSA that it's time to give your afternoon pick-me-up a super yummy and very crunch-tastic makeover with Wonderful Pistachios. I'm talking 6 grams of complete plant-based protein packed into every satisfyingly crackable, crunchable ounce. That's all 9 essential amino acids. So whether you're an old school roasted and salted fan, which is kind of me actually, or you like to walk your taste buds over to the wild side with jalapeno lime, Wonderful Pistachios have a flavor for every craving. And If you don't want to crack shells, which I happen to love doing for some odd reason, Wonderful Pistachios No Shells lets you skip the mess and get right to the fun. So do yourself a favor, pistachio people. Make your snacks more nutritious and delicious with the protein punch of Wonderful Pistachios. Your 3 p.m. hunger pangs and taste buds will thank you. And quit settling for those sad desk snacks. You deserve better. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com and get cracking. Good Life Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Good Life Project is brought to you by Air Doctor, makers of those amazing air purifiers I keep in my home studio and have been talking about for a long time now. So even though I talk for a living, my vocal pipes could use some help dealing with indoor air, which can contain so many different irritants. Luckily, my trusty Air Doctor uses an incredibly advanced Ultra HEPA filter to capture particles 100 times smaller than old school HEPA filters. We're talking smoke, pollen, mold, bacteria, all those nasty micro critters in the air. My Air Doctor just gobbles them up so I can podcast and breathe and write and be in peace and with peace of mind. So give your indoor air a purification boost with Air Doctor. Air Doctor comes with a 30-day breathe easy money back guarantee. So if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund minus shipping. Head to airdoctorpro.com and use the promo code GoodLife and you'll receive up to $300 off air purifiers. Exclusive to podcast customers, you'll also receive a free 3-year warranty on any unit, which is an additional $84 value. So lock this special offer in by going to airdoctorpro.com or airdoctorpro.com, or just click the link in the show notes and use the promo code GoodLife. One of the other things that I guess you tracked and has been on my radar for a while is mitochondria, mitochondrial function in your body. So I think we all learned when we were kids, you know, the mitochondria are the power plants of the cell. They're implicated in generating energy. And I guess as we old, they start to malfunction and become, there are a lot fewer of them. That, I guess, was one of the things that you took a look at as well.
I mean, it's as one of the ways to, one of the mechanisms behind aging, right? Because the thing is that we still don't really understand aging very well. And definitely mitochondrial dysfunction is one of the mechanisms that is likely behind aging, just like telomere shortening is also among them. But there is, you know, very often in popular culture, people are looking for very simple answers. But the problem is with science, and especially science of aging, there are just no simple answers. It's very complicated. We still don't understand a lot of those processes. You know, scientists don't even know if we have a limit to our lifespans or not. There was one paper a few years back that argued that there is a limit of 115, and there was such an amazing back and forth between scientists that so much fighting in scientific journals after that paper, you know, because they are basically split in half, disagreeing whether there is a limit or there is no limit, and we just don't know, you know, if there is something that happens that makes us only live 215 more or less, because of course there was Jean Calment who lived 222, but or maybe there isn't, maybe it just happened so far that we didn't live, but we don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I remember reading a number of years back a paper by somebody who said, regardless of our biological ability to extend life, 300 years would be effectively the 100% cap for any person, because by 300 years, your chances of dying accidentally would be at 100%. So because sort of like there is some kind of cap, at least in theory, but we're nowhere near being able to test that in a practical way. You also talk about something which I guess senescent cells or what, you know, quote, zombie cells.
Yeah. I mean, so this is something I saw in a lab at Oxford, which I visited, and I was looking basically at how cells are aging and talking to scientists there who showed me this kind of senescent cells and, you know, how differently they look from young cells and how they get bloated. And basically, when cells age, they start accumulating all this junk inside, just basically broken parts. You know, sometimes we think of nature that it's like all efficient and great and simple, but the truth is sometimes it's just really messy and junk and leftover parts get stayed in different places. So it's just like with those old cells, they just accumulate broken parts, you could say. And that's why they get bigger and bigger. And sometimes the senescent cells, so this aged cell, starts secreting different mixes of chemicals that turn other cells also senescent. This is why they call them zombie cells, because they turn other cells zombie. You know, this is part of aging as well. This is some of the processes the scientists are studying to understand, you know, how are we aging or why are we aging, and can we prevent it? Can we, you know, slow it down or not?
Yeah, and I guess, you know, like things like that are you know, become involved in, quote, infecting other cells or turning them into zombie cells, and also sources of inflammation through the body. I mean, these things are interesting to me because we're sort of trying to, there's been so much of a focus, I feel like, on trying to identify what are the sort of discrete things that we can measure that will in some way give us some sense of how we can quantify this thing we call aging. But they're also like, they are, but by definition, they're all reductionist. They're all sort of like looking at these very narrow things rather than the bigger picture, which you're saying is really, it's good that we're doing this research, but none of these discrete things are at a point scientifically where we can really use them as tools to affect or change behavior. They're sort of like fascinations right now, but not accurate enough on an individual level to make decisions.
I mean, in general, I feel that in our culture, we are very reductionist, as you said. You know, we really want to just, you know, pop one pill, do one test, and everything is beautiful and done. And so that's a problem also for scientists working in the field of aging, and that they often have to struggle with this problem that whatever they publish, there will be people turning into it some kind of product or commercial thing and starting to popping some pills, which is generally a very bad idea. And but it just always happens because we just looking for things like that. And that's also why I believe that we are so focused on nutrition as a way to prevent aging, even though of course nutrition is important, but we are really obsessing about it sometimes too much because we are thinking, you know, in terms of, you know, how many grams of ancient grains we should be eating, or how many what kind of supplements or all these fad diets. We are really looking for this miracle, basically, somewhere, something very simple, easily measurable, that you can just do one thing and you're done. But the problem is that, just as I've mentioned before, in the whole field of aging, it's not that simple. It's a much bigger picture, and so when things are interacting together, and it's never solvable by one pill.
Yeah, and it's interesting also, I mean, you bring up nutrition, you know, which really also brings up the question of what do we as a society sort of like, what have we been trained to do to try and stay healthy, and if we can slow the aging process, but really, you know, reduce the risk of disease, things like that. What are the big things that pop onto our radar? Well, it's nutrition, like you said. You know, there's been, whether you're paleo, vegan, vegetarian, gluten-free, you know, it's all, you know, if the idea comes into our domains that says, well, inflammation is a part of what's going on, you know, well how do we eat in a way that reduces inflammation? How do we move our bodies? So exercise is always one of the other modalities that people point to, and how exercise changes your physiology, your brain. And I guess the argument you're making is not that these things don't matter, but in terms of what you might look at, you know, more broadly in the way that you live your life, are they the things that really move the needle the most? And are they the things that we really should be focusing on as the primary devotions?
Exactly. Now, we are just trying, I think we're trying to go too deep into those topics, because when you think about nutrition and exercise and how they impact our health and aging, in fact, these things are very simple. you know, to eat healthy, what you need. It's just like Michael Pollan said, right? Eat food, mostly plants, not too much. That's it. It's very simple, right? It's just, you know, you don't have to eat ancient grains and kale and juice and, you know, whatever fancy goji berries and chia seeds. It's just carrots and apples, and it's perfectly fine. Just eat enough of the veggies. They don't have to be organic. Just, you know, just eat them, right? Don't eat too much fast food, not too much sugar. And this is all in all the governments that's what they're telling us, right? It's that many portions, servings, whatever, you'll be fine. The same with exercise. You know, you just have to move, but you can just go on a family biking trip. You don't have to go for some fancy exercise classes with some special gadgets that measure everything in your body. This is really not required, right? And but we really try to go extremely deep into finding, as you said, like which food will prevent this amount of inflammation in my body, right? And at the same time, you know, if we had unlimited time on our hands, then okay, do whatever you want. But the problem is that we don't, and we are very busy people in general. And while we are so concentrating on all these fad diets and supplements and miracle foods and exercise gadgets, we are completely forgetting about something that may be more important to our health and longevity, which is exactly the soft drivers, friendship, romantic relationship, volunteering, kindness, community involvement, which actually may be more important, but we just don't have any time left over or any, you know, will to take it on because we've been spending our time reading on fad diets.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to me also because a lot of the focus on how to be healthier, how to reduce disease, how to reduce inflammation, how to extend your life these days has been on either things to do that a lot of people don't find enjoyable, so they have to find ways to force themselves to do it, or things to stop doing, you know, restrictions in their lives that people really struggle with and most fail at and then shame themselves on top of it. And so what's interesting to me, and again, we're not saying, you know, like just go out and eat fast food, everything, and never ever move your body. These things do matter. But bigger picture, you know, I guess it's like, and you speak to this in your writing and I've seen this conversation also and always been curious about it. You know, the idea of the Mediterranean diet, right? Well, it's the diet that creates all of these amazing health outcomes that we've measured, you know, like in Mediterranean populations. And in fact, well, maybe the diet is a part of it, but you reference the Rosetta effect, which is a really interesting experiment that says, well, maybe it's actually something bigger than that.
Yeah, so what I'm saying in Graham Young, you know, that maybe Mediterranean diet is not necessarily just about the amount of olive oil or red wine or vegetables that are in the diet, so not about the pure nutritional aspect of it, but that it's also about the way the Mediterranean cultures are eating. So I live in France and I can observe it, you know, firsthand, and here the eating is not just about the food, is actually about with whom you eat. So people here really, really cherish the time they spend eating. They take a long time to eat, they celebrate it, and they eat with others, right, at the table. So for example, in people who are in their 30s and 40s in France, among them 61% claim that they eat dinner at a table with their family every single day. Whereas in US, that number is only 24%. And in the statistic, it was not even specified whether they are eating at a table or maybe in front of television, which is definitely not exactly eating a meal together. So it's a very big difference, right? And you also mentioned the Rosetta effect, right? So the Rosetta was, it still is, a little town in Pennsylvania, which was settled by Italians from a town called Rosetto in Italy. And it's attracted attention of doctors in the 50s and 60s because there was no heart disease in Rosetto, whereas in surrounding communities which shared the same water supply, the same healthcare, and generally were very similar, there was lots of heart disease. There were heart attacks and so on. People lived shorter. And so the doctors started investigating what's so special about Rosetto. And they checked the genes, of course, but it was not about the genes. It was not about the diet either, because the people in Rosetto actually forgot their Italian diet very, very fast and just started eating very greasy sausages, drank a lot of alcohol. So it was not the diet. So what the scientists discovered was that it was actually about their community spirits. So what they did bring from Italy was their involvements in the social sphere of life. So they were extremely neighborly. They were visiting each other all the time. They were having events where everybody participated. They had civic organizations. They volunteered. They really, really cared about that. And this was most likely the reason why they escaped cardiovascular disease for a very long time.
Yeah, so it's almost like the socialization had and deep focus on community and people almost had a protective effect against whatever shifts away, you know, like they made from the Mediterranean diet to whatever like the typical diet was and you know, like in the town, that there was this almost protective effect that really, you know, keeping the cultural traditions and exalting the relationships had along the way. I mean, it was interesting. I was in, we were in Italy a couple of years back. And I was struck by so many little things, but one of them was there's no such thing as a to-go cup in Italy. Like you don't get espresso or cappuccino in a paper cup. It doesn't exist.
In France either.
Yeah, it's just like the very concept of that is bizarre. You know, you get a tiny little porcelain, like cup. And even if you're not sitting, you know, you're just standing like at the bar. And strangers just talking to each other as you, like the idea of just grabbing something and going and not in some way using it as a reset, as a pause, or maybe a way to connect to somebody who's standing or sitting next to you, just it doesn't exist in the way that it does here.
Yeah, you know, when I moved to France, I moved here from Canada, and so I was used to the typical Canadian way of eating. So, you know, I would often eat in my car on my own or while walking down the street in a rush, you know, just munching on my sandwich. And when I moved here, I very quickly learned that you just don't do that in France. You don't eat in your car, you don't eat while walking down the street. It's a very big faux pas. And so right now, if I had to do it, it just would feel so wrong. I just cannot eat on the street anymore, you know, and unless you, I have to sit down properly and then it's fine. But you just cannot just rush it somewhere, you know, while you're doing something else. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. I mean, and it's interesting that, you know, when you do these things, when you build them into your life, not only does it make life more pleasant just on a lived day-to-day basis, but it actually affects it. It can change your physiology and your psychology by making these sort of like subtle changes in the way that you relate. I'm curious what you've seen in terms of, you know, how does it actually change you? What are the internal changes that happen in the context of when you spend more time with friends and family or just community people that are your chosen family, people you just, who nourish you and who you maybe nourish back?
So that was one of the fascinating things I found out when I was writing Growing Young, that there is just so much, you know, in terms of biology, physiology, that connects our emotions, our social lives to our health and lifespan. Because, you know, people often assume that this is some kind of new agey thing that, you know, just very fluffy, no research really, no, just, you know, stories maybe. But the truth is that while researching Growing Young, I read over 600 papers and experiments, very, very academic, and that really show that there's just such an amazing biological connection exactly between whether exactly we are connected to our friends and neighbors and community and how our body functions. And when you think about it, it makes perfect sense because we are social apes. So we evolved to be with a tribe, just like, for example, chimpanzees, they are social apes as well. They need to be with others. And so this is how we evolved. This is how we've been for the most of our evolutionary time. And there are certain biological mechanisms that encourage being together with others and discourage being alone. So, for example, when apes, just like chimps or humans, groom each other, or touch in our case, we get a boost of endorphins, which are so-called social hormones, which on one hand make us feel more connected to others, more kind of included, and give us all this kind of warm and fluffy feelings. On the other hand, they also affect our physiology in a very straightforward way. So, for example, endorphins are natural painkillers. So on one hand, you may be hugging someone and you're feeling connected. On the other hand, you're getting painkilling, you know, side effects. And we have other hormones like this as well. We have oxytocin, the famous laugh hormone. This also gets secreted when we are with others. And it also has physiological effects. Again, painkilling, anti-inflammatory. You said, you know, that we're looking at anti-inflammatory ways of eating, whereas exactly this hormone oxytocin has such anti-inflammatory properties as well. And there is also serotonin, and on the other side of the spectrum, you have all this kind of stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline and many, many others as well that don't get secreted when we are with others because it calms us down to be surrounded by our tribe, basically. So there is lots of different processes, you know, that's evolved that are, you know, I could go much deeper into it, but just to keep it very basic, we have a whole soup of hormones that works together when we are surrounded by other people.
Yeah, I love that because, you know, the idea of, well, I could try and move my body in a particular way and eat a whole bunch of things and not eat a whole bunch of things to create a similar internal physiological effect in my body that would be beneficial. Or I could hang out with people I love.
Yeah, exactly.
No. You know, not that it's an either or thing, but just the fact that you get a truly strong internal shift in physiology by doing something that is nourishing just interpersonally is really powerful. And I guess, you know, there's been so much focus on the microbiome, on the gut microbiota these days and its relationship to well-being and inflammation, and even our relationships can affect that.
Yeah, that's another fascinating part. As you've said, you know, we are thinking about microbiome a lot these days, and we are always talking about it in terms of probiotics, what you should be ingesting or you should not be ingesting to keep it healthy. But the truth is that our microbiome is also in a very large part about our social lives. So I took, that was one of the fun parts when I was writing the book. I actually went to Oxford again, and I was helping in an experiment on wild mice in the woods around Oxford University, where scientists were basically catching the wild mice and checking their social networks and also checking their microbiome and how it's affected by whom they were hanging out with, how many friends this certain mouse had, and so on and so on. And what they showed is that the more diverse friendships the rodents had, the more diverse and healthier microbiomes they also had. And it works the same way with humans. So we know that we share our gut microbes with other people. So for example, when we do contact sports, the teams will actually exchange their microbes together. And the same thing happens when you hug other people, you exchange microbes with them. And this is generally a good thing for your gut microbiome because the more diverse it is, it tends to be healthier. So it's also about hanging with others as well, not just about what you swallow and don't swallow.
Yeah, I love that.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
You also reference, I think it was a Japanese study that I thought was really interesting about that contrast of people who rarely meet and the health effect of that versus basically not eating any plants.
Yeah, so, you know, so that's studies show that not meeting with your friends, you know, is at least as bad for you as eating absolutely no vegetables or fruits at all. And for whatever reason, in that particular study, it was even more pronounced for men. There are sometimes differences like that, but in general, it's bad for everybody. If you don't see your friends, it's almost the same or the same as if you were not eating at all any fruits and veggies and just, you know, junk food, cheese and white bread.
Yeah, I mean, it's on the one hand, it's, you know, I love hearing all this research. On the other hand, in the moment that we're having this conversation, it becomes even more concerning. Because if we know that, you know, having regular contact with people that we enjoy being around is so critical to our well-being and potentially our longevity and our disease risk, and we are in different parts of the world right now that are in various states of isolation, lockdown, complete, you know, social and physical distancing. I'm sure you've thought about this, you know, like what the long-term effects of this may be on what we're talking about.
I mean, definitely, you know, we know that social isolation is extremely bad for human physiology. We know that people who are socially isolated, they have, for example, shorter telomeres. So once again, you know, we've talked about telomeres. So we have shorter telomeres when we're the people who are socially isolated. Then we know that people who are socially isolated have worse antiviral response, meaning they are more actually prone to getting sick with viruses, which is kind of ironic when you think about that. And they also live shorter. So in one California study, people who are socially isolated were actually 3 times more likely to die prematurely than people who are not isolated. So definitely there are very serious reasons to be worried about us separating ourselves from other people. But on the other hand, I always try to be optimistic, and I hope that when we are doing this social isolation right now, which is often very much required, that maybe we realized how much we actually need connection, you know, because when we're living our lives as we did before, always rushing, never really stopping to think, maybe we didn't really appreciate how important it is to us. But now that we are often forbidden from seeing our close ones, our loved ones, then maybe we'll appreciate how important those relationships are. You know, very often in the so-called old normal before the coronavirus, we've seen people in restaurants, let's say, theoretically being together, but everybody would be looking at their phones and really not paying attention. This is not a proper social relationship. This is not something that helps you grow young. You know, you need to really connect, to look at each other, to really be there. And I'm hoping, you know, it's hard to imagine right now that people who have been isolating for a long time and they will meet their friends and everybody will just looking at their phones. You know, we've been so starved of each other that I'm certain we'll be appreciating those relationships more. And I hope it stays this way. And in this way, we could live longer in a way because of coronavirus, if it switches us to appreciating these things more. And also about community, you know, in many places around the world, people were for the first time discovering their neighbors, you know, because they were locked down together. And you heard so many uplifting stories about this community spirit and kindness and helping others. And I really hope that we learn something from that.
Yeah, it's such an interesting point. You know, in New York City, where everyone lives, you know, for the most part in brownstones or buildings that can be, you know, as few as a dozen people or as many as hundreds and hundreds of people. People, as a general rule, don't know their neighbors and don't really associate. You know, you may kind of get stuck in an elevator and you use the word stuck with other people. But nobody really, you know, when you're in an elevator, you certainly don't look at anybody and you don't talk to anybody. It's sort of against the social norms. And you are seeing a lot of people, and I'm hearing a lot of stories among friends and family where people are just doing things for the other people in their building. Or maybe if they notice that they have neighbors, you know, across the hall who are older and it's not safe for them to get out, just, you know, knocking on their door and yelling inside, hey, I'm going to, you know, like the shop, can I get something for you? In a way that, I mean, I've spent my entire adult life in the city. I've never really seen before like this.
Yeah, that's certainly very hopeful. And, you know, if we shift our attention this way long term, that could really have very beneficial effects on our health and, you know, our diabetes risk, our cardiovascular risk, all these kind of diseases that are really a big plague in our society as well.
Yeah, I am hopeful also, like you. I think we're going through a window which is really painful right now. but assuming it is short-lived in the context of our lives and society, if it has the effect of maybe having us really re-examine the way that we want to live and the way we want to relate to people, and the longer-term effect is a sustained behavior change, that would be pretty good in a way that's healthy, of course, at the appropriate timing when it's safe to go and do those things. A particular type of relationship also, we've talked a lot about just general friends and family. You also speak to romantic relationships and how they're sort of like very defined ideas about how that affects this.
Yeah, so actually, if you were to just do only one thing for your health and longevity, just one single thing, then having a happy romantic relationship is just the best thing, because this can lower your mortality risk by almost 50%. And to compare, diet and exercise usually hover around 20-30%. So having a happy, committed romantic relationship is just amazing in terms of health and longevity, much better than any diets you could ever think of. But of course, the key word here is committed. This is what I often say, that, you know, just living together is not as good. And the reason for that is just exactly this commitment. So this kind of feeling that you are in it for good, no matter, you know, what happens and till death do us part. And I think this is because it gives people this sense of security and trust, and just that the other person is there for them and always will be. And this calms all the stress systems that we have in our bodies that evolved when we're still in the savannah, and we feel we belong that way. We just respond in a much healthier way.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So then would it be accurate to say it's not so much about the romantic part of that, but it's really much more about having a truly open, vulnerable, and committed relationship that you like trust and expect to extend over, you know, like a very long time?
Oh, yeah, certainly. You know, it's not about the butterflies and the kind of, you know, flowers and the early stages of romance. It's not about that. It's about the commitment and about the long-term love that you have for another person and staying together and trusting and opening and so on, which usually starts with the butterflies. but it's not about that phase in particular. It's about the long-term.
Okay, which brings up another question, which is, does it have to be a person?
I mean, you know, yes and no. So definitely it has to be a person to get that really strong effect. But it's true that your dog can also give you some small boost as well, much, much smaller than a human can. But still, research shows that looking deeply into your dog's eyes gives you some oxytocin boost, so the laugh hormone boost as well. And again, I've mentioned before, it also has very straightforward effects on our physiology, positive ones, and actually for the dog as well. So the dog also gets some health boosts from looking into his owner's eyes. So that also is a nice thing, but it's obviously not a replacement for a human connection.
Yeah. So if you're the person who has a dog who, you know, is immediately greeted when you get home, and if you try and look at your phone while the dog is there and the dog basically swats it away with the paw, the dog knows something you don't know. It's like actually important to look into each other's eyes and to have that contact. The sort of building on the idea of relationships, you also look at kindness and how that affects our well-being. And there's some interesting research around there as well.
Yeah, so, you know, for example, people who volunteer a lot, research shows that they have lower blood pressure, for example. They spend less nights in hospitals. They have lower blood glucose levels as well. So there are very, very direct physiological effects you can measure. They can even see it on the level of their gene expression, actually. That's when scientists look into their white blood cells, they can see differences there. You know, it's really amazing how it really affects the physiology. And this is probably because we've evolved something called the caregiving system. So basically, to care for others, we need to be calm. So when you think about nature, about parents taking care of their children, and I'm talking more, you know, the savannah version, you really need to be calm and not anxious to be able to provide for somebody who depends on you. If you are running amok, you know, panicking, crazy and scared and stressed, you really are not doing a good job. So this is why most likely when we care for others, and it actually is the same for other animals. So there is research, for example, on rats that show exactly the same effects. When they care for others, their stress systems in their bodies really calm down. So all this cortisol response and everything really, you know, calms down. And because, of course, chronic stress is bad for our health, I don't think I have to remind that to anybody, then this kind of caregiving helps us calm down. And it, of course, it evolves mostly for us to help to take care of our offspring, but it works as well if you take care of your neighbors or your community or some kind of charity organizations you are working for. So as long as you're caring and helping and giving, it really affects our physiology in a very positive way.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if part of that is, you know, if you start combining these things to a certain extent. We talked earlier about, you know, the notion that research shows that actually as you get later on in your years, you tend to be, the average person tends to actually become increasingly happier, more satisfied with life. And, you know, if you are somebody who is on in years and you're in a committed relationship, and, you know, we tend to think that if that person in your relationship with needs being taken care of, that maybe that's a burden. But maybe what this is saying, that in fact, the act of you being a caretaker to a certain extent, that there's benefit to them, but also maybe benefit to you as well beyond just expressing your love.
I mean, so several years ago, there was some research showing that caregiving is not good for caregivers. The research showed that they were more sickish and just generally suffering because of that. But over the years, there was more and more studies done on this topic, which went a little bit deeper and checked it from different angles. And I even talked to the scientists who did the original study, and they admitted that the population was quite limited there. So the newer research generally shows that actually there are benefits to caregiving. Exactly, even when you are taking care for an elderly parent, for example, and it may seem draining and difficult, as long as it's not too overwhelming as to a way that it affects you physically, like because of the purely physical strain of lack of sleep and so on, as long as it's not too extreme, because you are not sick yourself, for example, then this has positive effects on us. So that's the newest take on caregiving.
Yeah, and I love that you had that qualifier that, you know, we're talking about a level of caregiving that you're capable of giving rather than it actually really draining you physically or emotionally to a point where it then becomes unhealthy or destructive on some level for you. But I wonder also part of what's going on there is that it gives you, you may get a sense of purpose from all sorts of other things in your life, but maybe that also adds to it. It gives you another source of this sense of meaning or purpose.
Yeah, definitely sense of meaning or sense of purpose in life is also extremely important for health and longevity. And when researchers check populations who either have or don't have purpose in life, you can also see very visible differences in their health and longevity. And when I was traveling in Japan for research, I also talked to many people there and scientists, as well as very elderly people, octogenarians and centenarians there. And they often talk about something called ikigai, which that generally translates into this reason for living, which for us is kind of purpose of life or something like that. And they consider it an extremely important health measure, to the point that the health minister of Japan actually, in official documents, considers ikigai a part of health strategy, just like nutrition or exercise. And they really often talk about the ikigai when they really think about it, and it's part of very deep part of the culture. And usually also when I talk with Westerners about ikigai or maybe purpose in life, sometimes they say, okay, you know, I don't know, playing golf is my purpose in life. But in general, it's more about giving something back usually. So as if you are doing something only purely for yourself, it often doesn't work. So as you said about caregiving, this would be something exactly that could give somebody ikigai. And the Japanese often talk when they talk about Ikigai, they say, for example, that it's taking care of their grandchildren or their children or their work or their involvement in their community or things like that, but not necessarily exactly playing golf.
Yeah, I remember reading research that looked at people who were doing work that they would normally have considered to be work that they didn't like doing, that was emptying, that paid their rent but little more, and they considered drudgery. And when they found people who were part of that group who could say that they were doing work in support of something else that was deeply meaningful to them, it completely transformed the experience of the work. So like if it was, well, you know, I've got a family back home, or I've got a mother who, like, and I'm supporting their health needs or whatever it may be, like, but for the fact that I'm doing this thing, somebody I love couldn't be able to be okay in some way, shape, or form. It completely transformed the experience of it. It gave this thing a sense of purpose that, but for that fact, it would have been so much harder to find. And that changed the quality of the person's life more broadly.
Yeah, you know, interesting thing about the Japanese people as well, who are, by the way, the longest living nation on the planet, is that they often don't retire the way we do in the West. So when the Japanese people reach retirement age, a lot of them actually look for a different job. So they call it a silver hair job. We even have silver hair job employment agencies, especially for people after retirement age. And they start on jobs that are very simple, often part-time, usually badly paid, but they do it just for the sense of purpose. So for example, you will have, and I talk to people like that, you know, like you will have a CEO or some kind of high-powered manager in some company who retires and then takes on a silver hair job as a parking attendant or a public space gardener. And it may seem weird to us, but for them, it gives them this purpose that they're doing something for the community because they're helping people find parking spots, or they are helping their little town square look pretty. And this really gives them some kind of meaning and still involvement, being part of community, having work friends, and they really believe that, and studies confirm that it's not just their, you know, anecdotal, that actually does help them live longer.
Yeah, I love that. I have heard Ikigai translated. I know there, I think that the Western overlay tends to want to equate it with life purpose, and I've also seen, well, you know, it's not actually legit Ikigai unless you can earn a living doing it too, which completely bastardizes the original concept of what it is. But I've heard it translated as a reason to get out of bed in the morning.
Yeah.
So it's not like the capital L life purpose necessarily, but it's really just, it's a sense of purpose that makes you want to wake up because you know you have something that to do.
Yeah, exactly. It can be this parking attendant thing, right? You're just helping people find their parking spot. It doesn't have to be, you know, I'm changing the whole, I don't know, governmental system in my country or something like that. It can be something really small, but you feel that people are benefiting.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, it's interesting to really just to kind of talk about the granular elements with you, but also zooming the lens out, really understanding that, yes, there are these things we talk about on a daily basis, exercise, nutrition. The biohacking community gets much more granular about specific interventions and tries to really titrate it. But, you know, when you share information, you know, like about showing that, you know, a simple type of relationship will have equivalent effect on your well-being and longevity as a bunch of different specific things that very often we don't want to do, and that it's all about bringing things that are more pleasant into our lives.
Yeah.
That is a prescription that I would like to have written for me that I would doggedly comply with, you know, given the opportunity. And I think for a lot of people, I wonder if knowing that there's actual science that shows that this stuff really does matter almost would give them the freedom to say, okay, so let me elevate this to a place of centrality in the way that I choose what to do and not to do.
And, you know, it's just so much more pleasant, you know, just doing something for others, spending time with your friends, being involved in your neighborhood, you know, volunteering for some local events. It's just so much more pleasant than popping some pills or looking on the internet for some new test to measure your telomeres and taking the swabs. You know, this is just, it's just one side is like so lonely and miserable and you're, you know, like in this kind of internet world. On the other hand, it can be just with your friends, with people you like, doing pleasant things, right? And hanging out with your neighbors for a long meal together. That's just so much happy.
Yeah. feels like a good place for us to come full circle as well. So in this container of the Good Life Project, if I offer up the phrase to live a good life, what comes up?
To live life with others and for others. And that way you also end up living long and healthy, but with basically thinking more in terms of we than I.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks also to our fantastic sponsors who help make this show possible. You can check them out in the links we have included in today's show notes. And while you're at it, if you've ever asked yourself, what should I do with my life? We have created a really cool online assessment that will help you discover the source code for the work that you're here to do. You can find it at sparkatype.com. That's sparkatype.com, or just click the link in the show notes. And of course, if you haven't already done so, be sure to click on the subscribe button in your listening app so you never miss an episode. And then share the love. If there's something that you've heard in this episode that you would love to turn into a conversation, share it with people and have that conversation. Because when ideas become conversations that lead to action, that's when real change takes hold. See you next time.